From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama and Cuban President Castro hold historic talks. Hillary Clinton joins the 2016 race for president. Regional voting extended in Nigeria. Civilian casualties mount in Afghanistan. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. President Barack Obama is back in Washington following a historic face-to-face meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro. Mr. Obama's highly anticipated meeting with Mr. Castro on the sidelines of the Summit of the Americas in Panama was the first formal meeting between leaders of the two nations in more than half a century. The talks are strongly criticized by some U.S. Republican presidential hopefuls. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, whose father was born in Cuba, said President Obama is in the process of striking another very bad deal, now with the communist dictatorship of Cuba. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who was expected to announce his candidacy, said the meeting legitimized a cruel dictator of a repressive regime. Republicans in the United States continue to criticize President Obama's preliminary agreement to restrain Iran's nuclear development program. Former presidential candidate Mitt Romney told the U.S. television show Fox News Sunday that the prospective agreement is, in his words, not the kind of deal that will protect us and people around the world. Another former candidate, Senator John McCain, also attacked the agreement, saying Iranian officials are interpreting the framework agreement differently than the Americans are. Speaking on CBS Face the Nation, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry defended the framework agreement.
And I think people need to hold their fire, let us negotiate without interference, and be able to complete the job over the course of the next 2.5 months.
Secretary Kerry says he will brief lawmakers over the next 2 days as part of the Obama administration's effort to beat back a move among lawmakers to require congressional approval to ease sanctions on Iran. He also says the Russians have issued a statement saying the facts about the deal, as expressed by the United States, are accurate. Saudi Arabia on Sunday rejected Iran's demand that it end its aerial bombardment of Tehran-allied Houthi Shiite insurgents in neighboring Yemen. Iran Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said last week that the airstrikes launched by the Riyadh-led coalition were a crime and genocide. Saudi Foreign Minister Saud al-Faisal says his country is trying to help Yemen's legitimate authority and restore its government. After months of speculation, former First Lady, U.S. Senator, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has officially announced she is running for president in 2016. Mrs. Clinton made her long-awaited announcement Sunday in an online video posted on social media, promising to work for the middle class. She becomes the first Democrat to formally announce her candidacy to succeed President Obama, who defeated her in the 2008 Democratic primaries. Recent polls show Mrs. Clinton beating every other possible Democrat. Voting in Nigeria's regional elections extended into Sunday in some parts of the country after irregularities were reported in several districts. Voters were electing 36 state governors. Turnout appeared to be weaker than in the recent presidential vote. Officials at the Independent National Electoral Commission headquarters in the capital Abuja said voting on Saturday was marred by 66 incidents of violence at polling places, the highest number seen in southern and southeastern states. Election monitors reported 7 people were killed in Rivers State. The sound of an exploding transformer caused a stampede that ended in the death of one student at a Kenya university Sunday. More than 100 students were injured at the University of Nairobi's Kikuyu campus. Nervous students thought the site was under attack by al-Shabaab militants who massacred 148 people at Kenya's Garissa University College earlier this month. Civilian casualties are on the rise in Afghanistan. The UN says they rose by 8% in the first 3 months of this year compared to the same period last year. Ayaz Ghul reports.
The UN assistance mission in Afghanistan says fighting between Afghan security forces and Taliban insurgents has caused 136 deaths and 385 wounded in the first quarter of 2015. The latest figures released Sunday show a 43% rise in civilian casualties from mortars and rockets. But the UNAMA report noted total civilian casualties declined by 2% compared to the same period last year. It says Taliban insurgents are responsible for 73% of the total civilian casualties, with government forces responsible for 14%. While reacting to the UN findings, Afghan Interior Ministry spokesman Siddiq Siddiqui told VOA the protection of civilians is a top priority for national security forces while they conduct counterinsurgency operations.
The Afghan forces, they pay a lot of attention to prevent civilian casualties. For example, whenever we conduct and plan a new operation, first of all, what comes to our mind is to how to secure civilians, how to make sure that any measure we take during our operation that aims to safety of public and civilians.
UNAMA says parties to the conflict should act urgently on the commitments they have made to prevent harm to civilians, especially women and children. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter's week-long trip to the Asia-Pacific region is over. VOA's Carla Babb reports from Honolulu, Secretary Carter's last stop before returning to Washington.
Secretary Carter spent the last day of his Asia-Pacific tour speaking with military leaders at the U.S. Pacific Command headquarters in Honolulu. He heard from commanders on issues ranging from the land disputes in the South China Sea to the missile threat on the Korean Peninsula. He, in turn, briefed the command's leadership on his visit to Japan and South Korea.
The two issues I heard most about on this trip were, first, TPP, and second, the importance of U.S. alliances and partnerships to the stability of this, one of the future's most important regions.
TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, an agreement intended to expand trade among a dozen Asia-Pacific nations, including the U.S. Carter thanked Admiral Sam Locklear, the head of U.S. Pacific Command, for leading the effort to ensure security in the region as the defense secretary oversees the next phase of the United States' refocus to the region. Carla Babb, VOA News, Honolulu.
Turkey recalled its ambassador to the Vatican Sunday after Pope Francis marked the 100th anniversary of the mass killing of Armenians by calling it a genocide. Ankara told the Roman Catholic Church's ambassador to Turkey that it was deeply sorry and disappointed about the Pope's description of the 1915 killings, saying it caused a problem of trust with the Vatican. And South Korean and Libyan officials say unidentified gunmen attacked the South Korean embassy in Tripoli Sunday, killing two local security guards. That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
I'm Jim Stevenson with Business News from the Voice of America. Even if it survives the next 3 months teetering on the brink of bankruptcy, Greece may have blown its best chance of a long-term debt deal by alienating its Eurozone partners when it most needed their support. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras's leftist-led government has so thoroughly shattered creditors' trust that solutions which might have been on the offer a few weeks ago now seem out of reach. With a public debt equivalent to 175% of economic output and an economy struggling to pull out of a six-year depression, Athens needs all the goodwill it can summon to ease the burden. It currently owes 80% of that debt to official lenders after private bondholders took a hefty write-down in 2012. Since outright debt forgiveness is politically impossible, the next best solution would be for Greece to pay off its expensive IMF loans early, redeem bonds held by the European Central Bank, and extend the maturity of loans from Eurozone governments to secure lower interest rates for years to come. Ford Motor Company, meanwhile, says it will take a controlling interest in its Russian joint venture with Solar's OJSC, providing additional funding to the venture and opening the door for further integration at a time when Russian auto sales are plummeting. The Dearborn, Michigan automaker's move contrasts with the strategy of the General Motors Company, which last month said it was closing its plant in Russia and stopping sales of most of its products in that market, a shift aimed at helping it meet its European profit targets. Russian car sales fell 43% in March. That's the latest in a series of monthly declines dating back to early 2014. That's a look at business news from VOA. A 500-year-old statue, the first life-size marble nude figure carved during the Renaissance, laid bare in hundreds of pieces when it topped from a pedestal at New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Art. Well, they got out the brooms, cleaned up the debris, and then painstakingly sorted through it. David Byrd has more on the amazing project and its final result coming up on today's edition of Now. But first, salt. Lots of it. Ira Melman in the American Cafe tells us how we ingest too much.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. It's been two decades since an American television show featured an Asian American family, so it's not surprising that Asian American viewers are excited about the new situation comedy, Fresh Off the Boat. As VOA's Carolyn Weaver reports from New York, the show is about a Taiwanese-American boy and his family.
It's the mid-1990s, and Eddie's family is moving from Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown to Orlando, Florida.
I don't know why we have to move. Why couldn't you keep on going back and forth between Orlando and D.C.?
Because I didn't come to America to work for your mom's brother selling furniture for the rest of my life.
For Herb Tam and his friends, Fresh Off the Boat, the first American TV show in 20 years featuring Asian Americans, is a signal event. He says it's almost like when basketball player Jeremy Lin vaulted to fame.
That sense of elation that, you know, one of us had finally made it into this big stage, that there was this depiction of Asian American life that resonated not just with us, but clearly with non-Asians too.
So Tam, a curator at New York's Museum of Chinese in America, and some of his friends have been gathering to watch the show every week at this Chinatown restaurant. His friend Vincent Fang calls it a rebirth.
You know, Asian Americans have always played a supporting role in TV, but they've never been the main characters, right? And this is just one of those. It's iconic, and I think that it's a moment for our community to shine, for us to see one of our own on TV.
11-year-old Eddie, played by Hudson Yang, has to cope with being different in a new, mostly white school. And even though he identifies with hip-hop culture, he doesn't fit in instantly with African-American kids either.
Yo, man, what you doing?
Get used to it. You're the one at the bottom now.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are. It's my turn, chink.
Fresh Off the Boat has garnered enthusiastic reviews. And the show has been the most watched in its time slot for many weeks, pretty much guaranteeing that it will be renewed for next year. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
A new study by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC, finds more than half of all packaged grocery items in the United States contain levels of salt in excess of government recommendations. The foods include those most commonly purchased by consumers. VOA's Jessica Berman has the story.
Salt is a contributor to high blood pressure, which is a risk factor for heart disease. Investigators with the CDC looked at the sodium or salt content in 10 packaged grocery items.
We looked at bread, cold cuts, pizza, poultry, soup, sandwiches, cheese, pasta mixed dishes, meat mixed dishes, and savory snacks.
That's Linda Scheib, an epidemiologist with the Center's Division for Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention. Many foods that seem healthy, according to Scheib, are actually full of salt.
Bread is the number one contributor of sodium to diet. A lot of foods that people don't think taste salty actually do have a lot of sodium in them. So we recommend that people just, you know, read those nutrition labels, make comparisons, try to choose lower sodium options. Be sure to eat more, you know, fresh fruits, vegetables, and meats, and cook more at home, because that way you have more control over the amount of sodium.
According to the agency's guidelines, individual foods should contain no more than 480 milligrams of sodium, and prepared meals, including pasta dishes and sandwiches, should not be in excess of 600 milligrams of salt. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. You're invited to join us daily at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. A 500-year-old marble statue that was once shattered into several pieces has been fully restored and is on display at New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Art. The statue, Adam, by Italian sculptor Tullio Lombardo, was the first life-size marble nude figure carved during the Renaissance. Lombardo started it in the 1490s for the tomb of the Venetian doge and art patron Andrea Vendramin. It had been on display at the Met since 1936. But in October of 2002, the pedestal supporting the statue gave way, and Adam fell to the floor. It broke into 28 large pieces and hundreds of small fragments. Its full restoration took 12 years. Using groundbreaking techniques, including laser scans, 3D imaging, computer-assisted analysis of the statue, and special adhesives, Adam was painstakingly restored. Ronald Street is the senior manager of 3D imaging at the museum. He told Reuters news agency that some technology had to be invented to fix the broken masterpiece.
But we were able to look closer at more refined areas, like the very problematic proper left knee, which has a very small wedge-shaped fragment in it, and has a lot of combined stresses at that one location. And look at different pinning scenarios. What happens if you drill a hole? What happens if you don't drill a hole? What happens if you glue it with this adhesive? What happens if you use this type of pin in that location? And do all that virtually, combined with physical testing of specimens to really look thoroughly at that issue in that particular location.
Carolyn Riccardelli is a conservator at the Met. She says the adhesive developed for Adam is one that is strong but reversible in case any future work is needed on the statue.
It's very stable. It won't yellow or it's very strong, but not too strong. And it's also reversible. And then there are three pins. There's two small pins in the ankles, and there's one pin in the left knee. And those are the places we felt it was really required, because there's a very strong angle at those breaks, and it required a little extra structural support. But everywhere else, it's just the acrylic adhesive.
After the structural work was completed, the statue was cleaned to remove years of grime, and lost marble was carefully replaced. The statue stands in a special gallery at the Met that highlights its newfound beauty. Luke Sison is the Iris and B. Gerald Cantor chairman of the Department of European Sculpture and Decorative Arts at the Met. He told Reuters that Adam's new display echoes the love of geometry and classical thinking that emerged in the Renaissance.
What we've done is make it into a perfect cube, and all the internal mathematics of this almost like a chapel, I suppose, have been calculated on the same kinds of principles that a Renaissance architect would have done. Perfect proportion, divine harmony, around God's first perfect man.
The sculpture is displayed by itself so visitors can appreciate both the artist's skill and the conservator's work. Luke Sison says the final effect is awe-inspiring.
And you come across him as if in a chapel, coming, leading out of a church, walking through our Italian Renaissance galleries, and then turning and looking and finding him framed in the doorway. Looking, I think, absolutely resplendent.
The fully restored Adam by Tullio Lombardo is on display in a special exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York until July of 2015. It will then continue as part of the museum's permanent collection. So, what do you think? Are you a fan of Renaissance art? Do you have a favorite artist like Michelangelo or someone else? Let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can email us your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. That's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
A French climber has scaled one of Dubai's tallest skyscrapers, relying on just chalk and sticky tape on his fingertips to help him up the 75-story high Kayan Tower. Alain Robert, of 52 years of age, completed climbing the 307-meter-high structure in just 70 minutes. You'd do it, too, if you had no harness and little space for your feet on the ledges of the tower, which happens to twist as it ascends. Robert is often described as the French Spider-Man, and he lives to see another day. Time for sports on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson, and as we went to press, Masters Golf was winding down in Augusta, Georgia, the first major golf tournament of the season, where 21-year-old Justin Spieth is tearing up the course, trying to finish with a record low score, and he would become the first wire-to-wire winner since Ray Floyd did it back in 1976. We'll have all of the clubhouse comments coming up on Tuesday's program. The track action of the Chinese Grand Prix may have ended two laps from the end of the race in a calm, slow procession behind the safety car, but driver emotions burst behind the scenes afterward as the championship battle heated up only after the third race of the Formula One season. Lewis Hamilton drove to an easy victory Sunday, answering the question after the previous race won by Sebastian Vettel of Ferrari in Malaysia 2 weeks ago as to whether or not the Italian team had finally put an end to the Mercedes team's dominance. It was Hamilton's 35th Formula One victory, fourth in China, second of the season. Hamilton now leads the series with 68 points. Vettel, who placed third, lies in second in the series with 55 points. Nico Rosberg, Hamilton's teammate at Mercedes, finished second in China, but he currently stands third with 51 points. The gender barrier in one of England's oldest sporting events was broken Saturday when the men's and women's rowing crews from Oxford and Cambridge raced over the same course on the same day for the very first time. By the end of the afternoon, it was Oxford's crews who were celebrating. Oxford's women won by 6.5 lengths for a 12th victory in 16 years. The men followed up with a 6-length win along the same stretch of the River Thames in southwest London. The women's races had been held on a 1.2-mile strip with little publicity, but this time the course was 3.5 times longer. An estimated 270,000 spectators came out to watch history. Jamaican Usain Bolt kicked off his campaign to win sprint honors at Beijing's World Championships later this year. On Saturday, he said he would be willing to face American rival Justin Gatlin at any time. Gatlin dominated 2014 with world-leading and career-best times, while Usain Bolt had injuries and was sidelined. That's sports on VOA.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Graphene has been touted as the wonder material of the 21st century. It could make possible products like very thin and flexible TVs, as well as smart clothing that will keep you warm on cold days or cool on warm days. Nai Chang Ye from the California Institute of Technology tells us about a new process that might make it easier and faster to produce graphene.
Graphene is a single atomic layer of carbon sheet, and the sheet itself consists of very tiny honeycomb structures. They are periodic, so they form so-called honeycomb lattice structure. The unique thing is one atomic layer thick.
Why is graphene considered to be a wonder material, and what makes it so unique from others?
It has a combination of unique properties that do not exist in most other materials. It's just a collection of special properties. And so, for instance, it has extremely strong mechanical properties, actually about 200 times that of steel. And you think that single atomic sheet, how could it be so strong? And it's indeed very, very strong. The tensile strength is 200 times stronger than steel. And it has very interesting electronic properties. For instance, its electrical mobility, which is a measure of how easily electrons can move in a material. The electrical mobility is nearly three orders of magnitude higher than that of silicon. And you know silicon is widely used for electronics. So So you think about the electrical mobility of graphene, it's like, you know, almost 1,000 times better. And also they have another very interesting property, that is, electrons that are moving on graphene are effectively without a mass, similar to light traveling through vacuum. Although the velocity of electrons is probably 300 times slower than speed of light, but they move as if they are massless materials. And that's because of the collective behavior of the entire structures and the electronic properties that gives rise to that special effect. These sheets can carry very high density of the electrical currents, also an excellent heat conductor. So there are all these unique properties that coexist in one material. That's why people call it a wonder material.
So tell us about this new process that you and your colleague, David Boyd, have developed.
The new technique we discovered was a plasma-enhanced chemical vapor deposition technique, but there was an interesting twist. So what happened was that people always thought growing graphene, you have to grow it on a high-temperature surface. But one time, my colleague, David Boyd, he actually had an interesting discovery that it turns out that when he overheated, he left a copper sheet at high temperatures for sufficiently long time. The technique we have is much better than other people previously developed. So this technique we have, we can grow graphene without any active heating, just blast the plasma on the surface of copper, then letting methane gas, a little bit traces of nitrogen gas, and then graphene can grow very nicely. And the growth is very fast, in a few minutes. It's a one-step growth. We don't have to pre-process or post-process our system. And so the growth is high-quality, large sheet. Right now, we are only restricted by our apparatus size. We don't see any problem of scaling it up to a much larger size. Also, the other nice thing is that this growth process is a guided growth process. We can have graphene grow following the guided tracks on the copper sheet. And so the graphene crystalline structures can actually grow and coalesce into each other and form essentially a single crystal piece. And so there are few defects, very little, and it's very high quality.
Once this process is expanded to where you could make larger sheets of graphene, what kind of commercial applications do you see graphene being used for?
Oh, there are many, many possibilities. For instance, I mentioned the excellent electrical properties of graphene, and also it's one atomic layer. So it's an excellent piece of transparent conducting. You can use it for light-emitting diodes and solar cells, display panels, and now those are very expensive materials, and if you can replace indium tin oxide with large sheets of graphene, that's one application that you can use them as LEDs and photovoltaic cells, and also you can use them for other display panels.
That was Nai Chang Ye from the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. Thanks for listening to Science World Express.
We have a little bit of a twist on international love and intrigue. A New York City woman accused of being married to eight men at the same time has pleaded not guilty in a state court in the Bronx Friday to two counts of felony fraud that prosecutors say stemmed from a scheme to gain U.S. citizenship for grooms from countries that are red flagged by the Department of Homeland Security. Liana Barrientos, who's age 39, married men from Egypt, Turkey, Georgia, and other countries. She tied the knot an eighth time with a Pakistani man, according to the Bronx District Attorney's Office, who was later, that man, they say, later deported to Pakistan in 2006, following an investigation by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency's Joint Terrorism Task Force, because he apparently made some threatening statements about the United States. Well, what could Barrientos say in court to all of this? Not guilty. While she sported a ring on her left hand and shook her head as she faced a judge during her arraignment. The blonde woman, of course blonde, got married as many as six times in a single year in 2002, according to the criminal complaint. Assistant District Attorney Jessica Lupo said Barrientos is still married to four men.
While investigators asked her about her marriage to her husband from Georgia as he sought U.S. residency, she said that, well, she may have taken some money for those actions. Some of them were denied as they sought citizenship. They filed for divorce, and others just apparently left. Well, we vow to thank at least our good people who put on this program each and every day. Our director, Tracy Carter, engineers Kelvin Fowler and Zainab Abdel-Rahman, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. Come back and see us tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.